Tonight's lecture, which is the fourth in our fourth series, is dedicated by the Hochbaum family to the memory of Eliezer ben Shlomo David Zichrono Levrocha, whose yahrzeit is tonight, the 25th of Mar Cheshvan. Tonight I'm going to talk to you about the 10 generations from Noach till Avraham Avinu. History of man moves in spurts. Not every year gets the same play, the same importance, the same emphasis that other years do. That's true in general world history, and that's certainly true in Jewish history. We all know, for instance, that there are vast periods of time. The Dark Ages, let us say, which in Christian Europe lasted from 440 till about 950, 500 years, where we know very little about it, and there are very few experts, therefore, in the Dark Ages. My theory is that the less history there is, the easier it is for one to be an expert about it. But for various reasons, we know very little about it. So there you have 500 years. Whereas there are periods of 5 years, the American Civil War, for instance, which only lasted a little over 4 years, has tens of thousands of volumes written upon it and remains a lodestone of research and scholarship for American historians as to what occurred during that really very short period of time, if you judge it in the life of a nation, certainly in the life of civilization. The Chumash, Lahavdul, the Chumash also deals that way. We find that the Chumash moves hundreds, if not thousands of years in a very short period of time, and then all of a sudden it slows down. And it slows down and concentrates on a subject, on a person, on an event, and it will spend what to us may seem an inordinate amount of space or detail in order to tell us that story, whereas the grand sweep of history, so to speak, is accomplished in short periods of time. Well, that is what we are talking about here tonight. Tonight we're covering a long period of time. We're covering 10 generations. But the first 10 generations of man that I discussed before, the generations from Adam to Noah, that's a period of 1,500 years. The second 10 generations of man are already generations of man in our time span. That's only going to be about 450 years, which is the way we think of generations, 35, 40 year slots for a generation, no longer the enormously long periods of time which existed in man before the flood, before the time of Noah. It is an area that, again, has a great deal of mystery to it. And the mystery is that we do not have a great deal of recorded material regarding the matter, these 400 years. From the year 1550, let us say, from creation till the year 2000 of creation, till the year Avraham Avinu is born in the year 1948 of creation, and he begins his mission of monotheism in the year 2000. Our rabbis say the first 2,000 years of the world is considered tohu vavohu. It's considered to be years that are formless because no one took civilization in hand. It is not that there were no good people, but no one took civilization in hand to build a society of civilization. As we will see, it's just one chaos, one turmoil, one disappointment after another. So the first 2,000 years are tohu vavohu, whereas the next 2,000 years are called the years of Torah because of the fact that from the time of Avraham Avinu until the time of Rabbeinu HaKadosh, the Mishnah, the Torah Shebaal Peh, which coincides with the Roman Empire and really the beginnings of Western civilization, that is another unit of time. That unit of time we know much more about than we know about the first unit of time. And it's not only because the first unit of time is older, it's farther away from us, more difficult for us to know. There are various conflicting reasons why. One reason is that we do have records and we can't read them. They were all written by doctors. They are just completely illegible to us. we don't know the language. The famous Rosetta Stone, which enabled us to interpret the hieroglyphics of Egypt, also let us in with clues regarding certain ancient languages. The oldest language known to man that scholars agree upon today is a language called Sumerian. It's mentioned in the Chumash, Shemer, as being a state or a county or an area in northern Mesopotamia, north of the cities of Babylon. They are called in English the Sumerian people, and the place is called Sumeria. They had a type of a language which is very similar, by the way, to Chinese and Japanese, in that it is pictographs. It's not the same type of words and nouns and verbs and letters that we are accustomed to dealing with in our alphabet. Their alphabet, even though it is still indecipherable, what do you say, Dr. Weiss? All right, whichever one. It's unable to be deciphered by us. We have identified at least 560 characters, 560 letters to their alphabet. And we also know that somehow it has no nouns or verbs, meaning that the same word is the noun and the verb, and you have to figure it out in the text. And we don't know their system of punctuation, if they had any at all. Probably went to our high school and had no system of punctuation. And it just, it's a mystery. It's a mystery that science and scholars have worked upon for a number of centuries already. And though we do have glimpses that we did not have before, the whole picture is still not seen by us. If we were able to understand the language completely, it would be much easier for us to know more about the society and the civilization of the Sumerians, their beliefs, their influence on our world, certainly their influence on the ancient world. But without the clarity of understanding their language or reading their documents, it becomes very, very difficult, and that's the difficulty we face. Most scholars say that the Sumerians and the Sumerian language is at least 3,200 to 3,500 years old, which would place it as being right after the flood. It would place it in the in this time span between Noah and Abraham, And it is, when we talk about the cradle of civilization, Mesopotamia, the Fertile Crescent, we're talking about ancient Sumeria. Now, who were the Sumerians? That's also part of the problem. As we know, Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Yophis. The Semites come from Shem, but other people come from Shem as well. It's not just the Jews and the Arabs that come from Shem. And Shem had a large dynasty, and from him came also parts of what we would call today the Indo-European race, the Hindu Muslims who are in India, that ethnic strand, who are Caucasian in their biology but are dark-skinned. The Afghanistan, the people who inhabit Afghanistan, the tribes of the Caucasus, that area, they also are descended from Shem, according to our tradition and according to the knowledge that we have of the situation. The second son, Chum, is the father of the dark-skinned people, the Africans, but he's also the father of the Canaanites. In fact, his son was called Canaan, and his son is remembered as the one that perpetrated upon his grandfather, Noah, the act of either homosexuality or castration, depending upon which view in the Medrash we adopt. But he was not a very nice fellow, and he was the father of the Canaanite nation. And the Canaanites were an ancient and strong civilization, but they were not black. But they are descended from Ham. Apparently, I can't back this up. It's a theory, a hunch of mine, but I'm unable to prove it. That Shem, Ham, and Yofes, from each of them came blacks and whites. And that the tradition somehow that Ham is the only one that was black, and that they were cursed, etc., which, for instance, is the Mormon tradition till today. They only, under the pressure of the United States Civil Rights Act and a few other explanations that have been come to the fore, the Mormons have relented. And at least publicly, they no longer say blacks are cursed or blacks are damned. But it is part of Mormon theology. Probably that's why Kalik, we'll skip that joke. But why they're in Jerusalem, right, to protect us. But the Mormons believe that the blacks are cursed, and that Ham was cursed, Canaan was cursed, and that they're the father of the black race, and that's like a curse. Just as you cannot erase the pigment, you can't erase the curse. Now, that's very harsh theology. But that harsh theology is a fact of life in human civilization. If from the Medrash, for instance, I'm going to talk about Nimrod a little later in this lecture. The Gemara says, the Medrash says rather, that Nimrod was a Cushi. Nimrod was black. And yet he was the famous emperor of Mesopotamia. So apparently, at least in this period of time, the distinction between black and white, between the races, the segregation of the races according to geography, was not yet complete, at least. And that would stand to reason, because in the Chumash it says that it was not until the time of the Tower of Babel, which is at the end of this period. The Tower of Babel is at the end of this period in the... It's approximately 3,900 years ago, the Tower of Babel. It's about 100 years before Avraham Avinu. Only in that time, Shom Nafotsu, then did they scatter all over the world. So then it would be logical to say that once they were forced to scatter, that the ethnic groups went together, and the races went together. But until that time, there was integration, we would say. They lived in an integrated society, and therefore from Shem and from Ham, or from the intermarriage between them, there were different ethnic groups and different tribes and different races even. And that it was not purebred races until they divided at the time of the Tower of Babel, and then they moved off on their own. They became their own separate tribe and their own separate people and moved to different parts of the world. The third son, Yofes, in the traditional Jewish viewpoint, is seen as the father of the Greeks, of those people who lived in Asia Minor. And it doesn't mean the Greeks, only the Greeks, the Trojans as well, all of those who lived in Asia Minor and around the rim of the Mediterranean, near the Aegean Sea, the Aegean kingdoms. That's eventually where the children of Yefes moved to. And all of the names that are mentioned, even for instance, one of the names there is Tugarma, which the Jews later adopted as the name of Turkey. So they saw them there in Asia Minor. They saw them as being in the Balkans, as being in Greece, as being near the Aegean Sea, and that's the area that they lived in. All of this together gives us some picture of the society. So the ancient society originally began in Sumeria. That's where they came after the flood. And that was the oldest language that was known to man and the oldest method of communication. It was followed rather shortly by a group, Achad is called in the Chumash, the Akkadians. And they were already a Semitic people. And they, by means of war, but more by means of influence than by war, were able to absorb the Sumerian civilization. So that we do have records that there was a combined state, Sumeria and Akkadia. And that combined state for a number of decades ruled over the civilized world and had great sway and great power. You already begin at that time to have an adjustment of language and an adjustment of alphabet, and the Sumerian begins to decline, and you come to what later will be cuneiform writing of the Babylonians, all of which we have. Now, it's interesting, 3 points that I want to make here, again, from the Jewish viewpoint, because the Jewish viewpoint is historically correct. I don't say that in terms of arrogance, but certainly in terms of tradition, it has always proven to be accurate. And because of the fact that the Jewish viewpoint has a historical view to it. It is not here just to tell us facts. It's here to tell us how things happened. What happened to us? How did we get here? So regarding this development of Mesopotamia, there are 3 major points that have to be borne out. Number one, even though Noah and his 3 sons were monotheists and were believers in God, and in fact were the survivors of the great flood, their children immediately rebelled against them. And that's really the story of Canaan. Their children immediately rebelled against them, and they not only forsook the ways of monotheism, but they rediscovered somehow the ancient paganism which existed before the flood. And they developed it to a higher form and to an art form. And they used it as the method for governmental control over people. One of the great ideas that has to be understood in history is that religion is a weapon. It is a powerful weapon. It is many times, as Stalin said, how many divisions does the Pope have? But that's a mistake. It oftentimes is more powerful than divisions or armies or physical strength. And that the method that the ancient kings used to control their societies, not only the ancient kings, it went throughout the Middle Ages, and we see some of it today even. The method that was used to control society was to build up the king as a god, was to make the leader superhuman. We don't like our politicians to be human. That's a strain that's left. We don't like that. We don't like to see Gary Hart behave the way we know that perhaps a great many people in society behave. And we don't like to see Biden steal a speech, though we know that our rabbi is stealing it every Shabbos. And we don't like to see that they got caught in a conflict of interest, or that there was once a shady deal, or that he made some money. We don't want to know that. And we feel that that is sufficient to disqualify them from high public office. Where deep down in our hearts, we know that that is not a realistic standard, at least. It may be a reasonable standard, but it's not a realistic standard, because you don't get to be a senator in the United States Senate saying 150 chapters of Psalms every day as your sole occupation. And yet, when we are aware of it, we are somehow disappointed by it. The ancients solved that problem simply. They declared themselves gods. And the system of paganism was used and exploited throughout the ancient world, just as the church would exploit it later in terms of a religion, as the means of holding power. Because it's not only that you rebelled against the king, it's not only that you voted him out. He was going to get you in this world and in the next. And then it went to the ludicrous point where the Roman emperors had themselves voted in as gods by the Senate. In fact, the greater the evil doer, the greater the necessity to be declared a god. Because if he was declared a god, then nobody could touch him. So So such madmen as Caligula were voted in as gods by the Roman Senate, and they were officially worshipped as gods. So the psychological underpinnings of paganism have a logic to them. Because if you want to be God, then you cannot believe in one God, and a one God whom you cannot see or touch, and whom you don't understand, and who is infinite, and you're finite. I mean, none of that washes. That's why the Jewish people by nature are so chaotic, right? So you get whatever the prime minister of Israel is, he's not God. That he can't say. And the king of Israel couldn't say it either. In fact, the king of Israel had a prophet that stood behind his shoulder and kept on reminding him that he wasn't God. Reminding him of his humanity. We'll see in the Chumash that whenever Moshe goes to visit Paro, so Rashi tells us based on the Talmud that he went and saw him. Paro said he was a god. If he was a god, he never had to go to the bathroom. I once, a terrible story, but to me it made an impression on me. I once knew a conservative rabbi who once told me that his sole concession to orthodoxy was that on Yom Kippur he never went to the bathroom. He stayed in the whole 14 hours, and that was like the miracle that his balabatim saw. That was like walking on the water. Why he associated that with orthodoxy, I have not figured out yet. But Paro said that he's a god. Li ayor v'ani asisini, it says in the Navi. I created the Nile River, I'm the god. And that's why they built those enormous temples to themselves and mausoleums and pyramids, etc., because they were the god. So Moshe always went to see him when he had to go to the bathroom. Moshe used to meet him in the outhouse by the Nile River in the morning, which put Paro at a definite disadvantage, because he couldn't tell Moshe, listen, I'm the god. In that book that I've recommended a number of times, the book called The Denial of Death by Ernst Becker, he has a great chapter there on the psychological effect that eliminating waste has upon human life and the human psyche. And if you look at it in history and you look in it, it's just mind-boggling. I was in the Rostenburg Palace in Denmark, in Copenhagen. And there, so also the queen, the king, so he was the king, right? So he could not have a waste pot in his bedchamber. So you should see the ingenious secret door that they have built into that bedroom where the waste pot was kept. And it was like, you know, the vault wasn't hidden as well as that. Why? Because you're Nebuch, not the king. It's our society, the bathroom has become the most important room in the house, the most decorated, the most expensive. It's also camouflage, but you know, in our time, it's part of the secularization of man. But in the ancient world, the king was a god, and being a god precluded him from having the demeaning parts of the natural physical wants of man, requirements of man. And because of that, therefore, they declared themselves gods. So paganism was a necessary political instrument, and paganism comes in enormously strong in the generations after Noah. One would think that after the flood, paganism would be proven to be wrong. I mean, what could God do, right? What better trick is there to do than to destroy the whole world? But we see that man's spirit is irrepressible. He goes right back to it. But the difference was that now it was forced upon man from the top down, so to speak. The religions were established by kings, by sheikhs, by emperors, by leaders who made themselves gods and who therefore were able to control the minds as well as the wallets of everybody else in society. Also, it created the class that they needed to rule, which was the clergy. And the clergy was a class that was able to dominate mankind for many, many centuries, and not really very productive people, if I say so myself. And they were, the hatred, for instance, if you read the books of the French Revolution, revolutions of 1848, or any of the anti-clerical books that abounded in Europe in the last 200 years, or the hatred that you see in the intellectual attainment on the basis of leadership and on the basis of character. And clergy that had poor characters did not last long among the Jewish people. But in the rest of the world, the clergy was a class that exploited people, that lived off the backs of others. And the kings used them in every society, used them because they were the instrument for holding the mob in check. They had powers far beyond the powers that the kings had. So that was the first point that we see about this society, was that paganism was reintroduced. The second thing about this society is that it became technologically advanced. Now, every society in the history of man, with the blip of the Dark Ages, which occurred in Europe only, but every society advances technologically over the previous society. In our time, it does so with such rapidity that everything becomes obsolete almost immediately. We live in a time of immediate obsolescence where 3 months ago somebody called me up. He said he's put in $18,000 in a computer system for his accounting office last year, and now he's getting a new system, and if I want it, can the yeshiva use it? So I said, you just put it in a year ago. He said it's completely worthless because new things have come out, and it's to us it's no good. Well, that really is obsolescence. That's but that happens now. We live in such a time that happens. And what is considered advanced on Monday may be obsolete the next Monday. But the beginning of just an example from in my own experience. When I was in Miami Beach, so we had a member on the shul that owned a small printing shop. He used to print the shul bulletin and invitations, etc. So it was he had a linotype press with hot lead, with the whole thing. I mean, that whole bit, and they had this enormous machine that they bought from Germany or Switzerland, the linotype machine. It was really a Rube Goldberg type of thing, if you've ever seen it in operation. And today, it has absolutely no relationship to the printing business today whatsoever. Completely different business. Different technology, everything. And that's in the space of 2 decades it happened. And that's true of mimeograph machines, which the copier business put out of business, and all sorts of other things. Well, this period of time, so just as we think we're in a technologically advanced time and we're proud of our achievements and we think we're making greater and greater strides as we are, but our children and our grandchildren will look back at us and say how backward we were, how primitive our machines were, how slow our computers are. I always mentioned to someone, I hate to tell computer stories, but somebody gave us now a new computer in the yeshiva. So I didn't know how to use the old one. So he said, the new one is 4.5 times faster. So I said, how do I have to know my deficit faster? And they traded it in, and they took it. It didn't cost yeshiva a penny. He took it. We have brand new, and it is fat. Believe me, it's fat. But what happens? What? Because it's a matter of status that you can't have a computer that is that slow anymore. It's completely obsolete. It's destroyed. I always remind myself of the story that Baruch Hashem, we had 3 children, and Jackie was pregnant with our 4th child. So they were, Miriam was then 3 and a half and 2 and a half and 1 and a half. So we told Miriam that Mama's going to have another baby. So she said to me, "What do we need another baby for? We didn't use this one up yet." There's a certain truth to civilization in that also. We don't, but our headlong dive for the advancement of technology is such that we have no time to stop and appreciate the technology that is already developed, or sometimes even put it to the use that we could put it to use, that we could really do something with it. Well, that's what happened in this generation. You have to see it in the way the Chumash describes. They were the ones that invented fire brick. They were the ones that invented new methods of building, to build tall buildings. Until then, apparently, the buildings were all one story or two story, built on the principle, you just put one on top of the other, but eventually it's going to collapse. But the secret of how to build tall and how to use supports and reinforcements and how to buttress it and how to do it, all of that technology, where did that come from? Well, it came from trial and error, but it came from man's brain. It came from the advance of civilization. From the time of Noach to Abraham, the world changed 10 times. That's part of the Asura Doras, 10 generations from Noach to Abraham. The world moved 10 times, just as it's moved 10 times in the last 50 years in our civilization. And this feeling of technological advance is important for us to understand history. And because technological advance always has such an attraction to it that it almost always submerges any spiritual advance which occurs concurrently. It takes time for the spirit to be digested and appreciated. Whereas in the world of the physical, the advance can be seen immediately, and we're ready to go to the next step. One of the great things about the Middle Ages, there weren't many great things about the Middle Ages. That's true about Middle Age as well, but one of the great things about the Middle Ages was the fact that technology was harnessed somehow to the human spirit. So you see the enormous cathedrals that were built, the architecture, the stained glass, the building materials, all of which were tremendous advances in technology, but they were within some sort of a sophisticated material use that had also a spiritual purpose behind it. The man lost that. Today there's an absolute dichotomy. The first use of any technology today is war. That's the immediate use. And then flows the benefits. We're not building space rockets because of the fact that we want to have all the benefit technology that comes from it. We're building it because we want to be in space so that we can meet the Russians there. Memela, as we say in the Gemara, as a side effect, right? So then you have all of the benefits that come from it. But the primary purpose is, unfortunately, negative. It just happened now, the LAVI program was canceled in Israel. One of the great complaints was that all of Israeli technology will suffer now. The hospitals, they were able to use money for CAT scans and inventions and medical machinery. It all flew from, that's a bad pun, but it all flew because of the fact that they were spending all this money on the LAVI. I saw that someone in the Knesset got up and said, "So why do we have to build the LAVI? Let's build a CAT scan. Why does it have to be an indirect benefit? Let's say we're gonna build hospital machinery." But that's not how civilization works. It's not the wheel that drives us, unfortunately. And that's what happened here in this age. Advanced tremendously in technology, but the technology was basically negative technology. And that's what the rabbis mean to tell us when they say that if a man fell from the Tower of Babel, they didn't care. They sent up another guy, right? The astronauts. Sent up another 7. But if a brick fell meant if technology was reversed, if it was a failure, So then they said, whoa, look at that, look at all the money it cost us, look at all the effort, and look what we lost, and now we have to start the program over again. And well, if you listen carefully, you'll see, you'll hear ourselves talking. You'll hear how Western man views things also. It's the same set of priorities. And that's what happened here. You had a tremendous explosion of technology. Now, the Medrash tells us here in this final note that I want to say about technology in pre-Abrahamic times, we're not accustomed to think of it in this term because of the fact that we think that until Thomas Edison, nothing happened in the world. But I am certain that the technological achievements in the time of Abraham were as impressive to him and his generation as the technological improvements and achievements in our time are impressive to us. It's door shove. Every generation and its wise men, every generation and its achievements. And that's how you view it. You look... They have in the Smithsonian Institute the first television set produced in the United States in 1938 by Dumont. You know, it's 1.5 inches. I mean, you take a child there today and you show him that television, he wouldn't let it in his house. You know, but today if it's not 26 inches in color, you know, and with sound, with the Dolby sound and stereo and the whole thing, that's not a set. But in its time, 50 years ago, that was a miracle, a major miracle, which it is. You can see something's going on 10,000 miles away. And we accept it as just, you know, as we're entitled to it. And we don't even give it a second thought. Well, the technology in the Sumerian, Akkadian, Babylonian, Mesopotamian circle was, on their scale, the same. They discovered how to build these tall buildings. They discovered how to make building materials. They discovered fire brick. Aside from the wheel and transportation, they were the first ones to pave roads. They were the first ones to build ships. So we go and you go and see the aircraft carrier Intrepid. Now that's a ship, right? But today that's no ship. That's why it's a museum, because it's a mothballs. It doesn't count. But if you would bring the first Sumerian sailor and show him that thing, he couldn't believe it, because he thought of a ship as a little reed boat that somehow he figured out he'd be able to sail with. But the idea is that technology in every generation is enormous, and its advance is enormous, and it makes a tremendous impression. And you have to view the technology in its generation and not compare it generation to generation, because that's not wrong. That's not a correct assessment of the matter. So the Medrash tells us in this final point about technology that Adam Arishon, that there's a certain amount of divine knowledge in technology. Like, who got us started? Yeah, I have Talmidim Yeshiva. I come over and say, Rebbe, you know, you just read this first word for me. I'll figure out the whole taste. Just tell me this word. And when a boy tells me that, I feel good, because that means he's on his way already. Right? You have to give him the push. Right? Oh, this is what the kasha. This is what bothers Tasis. Oh, he will figure out the rest of the way. Who gave man his first push in science and technology? Who taught him? So the Medrash says in Zimbrachus Rabbah, one of the great Midrashim, the Medrash says that God gave us our first push. God told Adam Arishon, God explained to Adam Arishon how time works, how seasons, how months work, how the day and the night, the calculations of the calendar, the calculations of time, which is really a basic system of technology. Astronomy was always the first science, so to speak, because for astronomy, you only needed your eyes to begin with, and you were aware of nature around you, and you were aware of night and day, etc. So the Pirkei de Rabbi Elazar says as follows, that the fact that the sun years are 365 days and almost 6 hours. This Pirkei of Rebbe Lezer is written 1,900 years ago. So he's telling you the Cheshbon pretty exactly. Something, for instance, the Western world had to change the calendar from the Julian calendar to the Gregorian calendar because they didn't have it figured out this exactly. And that there are 360 degrees. The world is divided into 360 degrees. Where do we get that 360? So the Pirkei of Rebbe Lezer mentions that was told to, that's a piece of divine knowledge that we have. And that the moon, the difference in the molad and the moon, that it's 29 days and 11 hours and 54 minutes and 6 halakim, etc. All of this information was given, the Medrash says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mosron LaAdam HaRishon B'Gan Eden. God gave it to Adam in the Garden of Eden. In other words, original man started with some storehouse of knowledge. He didn't have to start by himself, which is part of the problem of evolution and all of the other theories of how life started and how did human intelligence, and who's the first person that figured something out? My kashi is always, who's the first guy to figure out how to eat a banana? So my kids always answer me, he showed them how the monkey eats the banana, right? The monkey peels the banana, which is right. It's correct. But that's the basic question that gnaws at it. How did it all begin? Once it begins, we can understand. Once you know that there are 365 and a quarter days, and once you know that a lunar month is 29 days and 11 hours and 54 minutes, so it's possible you can figure out the whole system of astronomy. Once you have certain basic information. But how do you get the basic information? How do you know to measure days and nights and minutes and seconds and the whole measure of time? Where do you have it from? So the Medrash says original man had it. Adam HaRishon had it. God gave it. That was part of the Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden was a university, a yeshiva. It was a place of learning. Adam Mosron L'Chanoch. And Adam taught it to Chanoch. Here the Medrash is teaching us an important lesson that we see throughout Jewish history, that knowledge is transmitted from people to people in a chain of teacher to student that stretches back through all time. And therefore you have to know who's in the chain. With Maimonides, the Rambam in the Yorah Chazokah lists the 41 generations from him back to Rabbi Yehuda Anossi, the author of the Mishnah. And then you have the 11 generations from Rabbi Yehuda Anossi back to Moshe Rabbeinu. So we know how the Torah, I can tell you the Torah. My father should live and be well as here. My father tell me you taught him. And we can go all the way back. I can get back to Moshe. Anybody here can get back to Moshe. With names. Well, that's our tradition of all knowledge in the world. All knowledge of the world came from somewhere. Came from people. So Adam gave it to Chanoch, and Chanoch gave it to Noach, and Noach gave it to Shem, and Avram Avinu learned in the yeshiva Shem Ba'Aver. Shem gave it to his grandson Aver, and Aver was the Rosh Yeshiva when Avram went and he learned there. My only question is, did Terach pay tuition for him? Probably promised. Knowledge. A scholarship, that's right. So the accumulation of knowledge of technology begins in that period of time. Man goes on an irreversible path, the path of achieving knowledge, the path of improving technology, the path of a bigger and better world. The third and final point that has to be made regarding this period of time is the rise of what we call imperialism as the political system by which the world was governed. After the death of the world in the flood, and Noah and his three sons start again. So naturally, there was a certain tendency towards unity because it's all one family and they're all living in one place, and you're talking about a small number of people. And to defend themselves against nature, against the animals, against all the problems, to build, it takes people. One man alone can achieve very little. So man banded together in families and then in tribes and then in ethnic groups and then in countries, in civilizations, in order to achieve what could be achieved. All of that was positive until, again, the time that precedes the Tower of Babel. The Tower of Babel is a watershed mark in human history because that's the rise of imperialism. All of a sudden, there arise people who do not want unity for positive purposes, but who want simply dominion, who want the right to exercise their power and their strength over others, to employ others, to exploit others, to use others. Jung, who was Freud's great nemesis, said that the great motivating psychological force in life is not sex, as Freud said, but it is power. The old bad joke about the German that goes to a Chinese restaurant and he leaves hungry for power. Power is, it's a tremendous force in life. It's a tremendous motivating force. And at the dawn of civilization, so to speak, in this generation, there arise emperors, there arise people who wish to dominate others. The greatest of them is called in the Chumash Nimrod. Nimrod was a Gibor Tzayid, was a man, a hunter, a hero, a fearsome warrior, and he was able, through his physical prowess and his shrewd manipulations and his lack of conscience, which is always required, his lack of scruples, he was able to dominate. Now, who was Nimrod? Now, we have here an idea that is seen many times in the Chumash as well. The person in the Chumash who was called by one name had many other names. And sometimes he's known in history by other names. Why that is, I don't really know. I have theories about it, and I've seen what the Meforshim say about it. I cannot really say why. But the Talmud tells us, rather the Medrash tells us, it's mentioned in the Talmud as well in Erevin, that he had three names. One name was Cush, and one name was Nimrod, and one name was Amraphel. So the Talmud tells us that he was called Cush. The Talmud always plays on people's names. The Talmud is the one that originally invented the statement, what's in a name? And therefore, all the names that you find in the Tanakh, you will almost invariably find a drosha, you'll find a comment to the name in Chazal. Because Chazal read into the person's name his character, his behavior, his history, his goals, his destiny. That was all part of his name. For instance, we find Yisro had seven names. Moshe Rabbeinu had seven names. His real name wasn't Moshe. But he's known to us as Moshe forever. Moshe was the name that the daughter of Paro gave him. But the name that his mother and his father gave him at the Bris was not Moshe. Avigdor, Yekusiel, good Jewish names. Moshe is an Egyptian name. Ki min ha-mayim shisihu. But the Chumash called him by that name, and that's his name forever, and that's the name of all the Moshes forever. So it's a point, I don't want to dwell on it too much, and I don't know too much about it, to be able. But there's a secret here somewhere. You should know there's something here. The Chumash, when it chose what name it will call him by, the Chumash means to characterize the person. It's not just the name. He's called Nimrod, because in Nimrod is the word mered, rebellion. In him is incarnate the spirit of rebellion against morality, against godly authority, the spirit of rebellion against any decency. Nimrod is the first Hitler, and there are a lot of them. No shortage. You go through, it's not just in our time. Our time, Hitler is dangerous because he has technology, you know. Hitler, Stalin, Idi Amin, Chairman Mao, all these guys, they've got technology working for them now. So in the ancient world, it used to be all handwork, right? If you had to kill 250,000 people, so your arm got tired. So you had to stop after a while. You couldn't do it. Today we have the necessary technology to dispatch all of humankind in 10 seconds. And that's not an exaggeration. Can you imagine such a situation? So imagine that if Hitler had his finger on the button. And there are plenty of Meshugoyim around. So it's only through God's grace that you're hearing this tape. Because what holds it back from happening? Our world is a terribly dangerous place. Terribly dangerous place. Nimrod is the first dictator, the first tyrant, the first example of someone that rebels against, he has no moral strictures whatsoever. None. In Merle Miller's oral history of Harry Truman, so he has there that Truman once in 1946, right after the war, So he was faced with the dilemma of what to do with the Soviet Union and Joseph Stalin. Truman was an inveterate anti-communist. And he, having met Stalin at Potsdam, he hated him with all the hate that a good Missouri farmer could have. So he was at a meeting and Senator Taft was there, the Republican majority leader from Ohio. So Taft, in a joking aside, said to him, he said, "Well, why, Mr. President, why don't you just drop the bomb on Moscow and end it?" And at that time, Russia didn't have the bomb. America was in a position to eliminate it. And in another time, in another place, other people would certainly have done it and would have justified it later. Truman said, "If I would not have to meet my maker, I would consider your suggestion, Mr. Senator." Because Truman basically was a moral person. If a country is blessed with someone that has moral compunction, so that's a restraint on him. Nimrod is completely, not only immoral, he's amoral. He's beyond morality. There's no room for morality with Nimrod. And because of that, therefore, he is the symbol of all those that will follow him, of all of his heirs, all the tyrants, all the evil people in the world. And that's why he's seen as the protagonist, Avraham Avinu. We'll talk about this more next time when I talk to you about Avraham Avinu. But Nimrod is the protagonist. He is the enemy because he is completely without scruples. You can't talk to him about God. Even when God saves him, he's not interested. And his third name was Amraphel, which is the name that is mentioned in the Chumash, one of the kings, right? The king of Shinar, the king of Bovel, and he became the dominant man in the world. He was it. The rabbis say that why was he called Amraphel? Was because of the fact that he took Avraham Avinu and he threw him in the furnace of fire. So it's like from the word smoke. The rabbis have played on the word. But again, what is his solution? Again, the rabbis are telling you that what's the solution to a dissident? What's the solution to somebody that pricks your moral conscience and makes you feel bad is you kill him? That's the solution. It's always been the solution. The prophet Elijah, when he came to King Ahab after he stole the field from the vineyard of Novos HaYisraeli, he said to him, Harotzachto v'gam yorashto. You have murdered, are you going to inherit all? You think that you're going to get away with it? That's the answer, right? How do you make Russia an advanced society? You kill 50 million people in the gulag. How do you make China an advanced society? You let 100 million Chinese starve to death. You go to war. You're a destructive force. That was Nimrod's contribution to civilization. Nimrod is an important person to realize and to deal with, because he's the prototype of what we're going to see throughout civilization, of these type of people. The Gemara, the Medrash says, Oso atzmo Elohav, v'kovalo moko mishtach avoyo. He made himself a god, proclaimed himself a god. You had to worship him. He was it. There was no way that you could avoid Nimrod in the world. Finally, the last Medrash regarding Nimrod, because the Medrash is history. The Medrash comes to tell us what happened here. The rabbis tell us that Nimrod took the garments that God made for Adam and Chava, and they were his garments. And the rabbis tell us that Nimrod was eventually killed by Esav, who took the garments away from him. What do we mean, the garments? Aside from the literal thing which the garments represent. But Nimrod is the one that harnessed technology. The garments that Adam HaRishon had, it said, who made the garments? God made the garments, and it's God's gift to man. You know, like your child leaves the house, so you want him or her to start out with a good steak, right? So you give him $500,000 and say, you know, go out and make it, right? The good father. The Ribbono Shel Olam kaviyochel, when he drove them out of Gan Eden, he gave them gifts. He gave them his garments. He gave them the gifts of wisdom and of technology, of civilization, of organization, all the great gifts of man, which are our garments, which clothe us, which represent to us civilization. Nimrod is the first one that took those garments and harnessed them for evil, which they can be harnessed for. We see in it, we see what a world is. When we would like to be back in the Stone Age, it was a lot less dangerous. The wrong Meshuggah has the button. If the IRA had the atom bomb, right? Or other people like that. Frightening. So Nimrod had the garments. He took the garments. And he kept them. And Esav took them from him. That's what the rabbis mean by that. And that's how it comes down in civilization. That's how the world looks. It's Nimrod's world. It's Esav's world. They're the ones that have their finger on the button. Dangerous, dangerous place. So in that 450-year span between the Mabul and between Avraham Avinu, you have these events. The politics, the technology, or the history of the time all come to point out to you the forerunners of civilization as we know it. Until we come to the time of Avraham Avinu, Avraham Avinu is again another watershed, because that's the beginning of the opposite moral force that also contributes in shaping civilization. And with him begins the story of the Jewish people, and begins an exclusive an interesting and yet secret story of how the world developed and how we got to where we are today.